One business matter before I begin. We will show tonight the film of David Copperfield. That will be at 7:15. Hollywood, about 1936, and I'll talk a bit about it tomorrow. Those of you who have not yet finished the book, have another go this afternoon, if you will, see how far you get, but don't worry too much. What the film does, it's only 2 hours and 11 minutes, which means a lot gets left out, needless to say. But they focus on the early chapters, the early life of David, and do that superbly well. Then the rest of the book gets crammed into about an hour and 10 minutes. And it means that there are whole subplots that you'll be reading about that have vanished from the film. And also, I think if you've read far enough, you're at the point where you can pretty much figure out where things are going. There comes a point in the book where everything in us is wanting the plot to move in a certain direction. And it's Dickens. It's fairy tales for grown-ups. So it will go that way. So I don't think there will be huge surprises. So don't worry if you haven't finished it. You can watch the film tonight and still go back and finish reading the book. And there will still be plenty of material, a couple of good plot turns and some things well worth your time. There's one other aspect of Dickens that I want to talk about just briefly. And that is one of his, again, great gifts as a writer. T.S. Eliot said that Dickens was able to create characters that are more vivid and full of life than most of the people we meet in day-to-day reality. And one of Dickens' real gifts was this gift for characterization. His novels are genuinely peopled with folks that are just unforgettable. We'll look at some of them. Even the minor characters are extraordinary. The one that springs to mind when David is traveling on his way to see Aunt Betsy, and he meets the guru man who's got this awful sort of rag and bone shop and is standing in the door and trying to look. He's there for about half a page. You read it, and I mean, he is the ogre who's there at the mouth of the cave trying to lure the innocent hero in. It's just astonishing. But I want to give one example just in terms of Dickens' ability to create character. Minor character, she only shows up twice in David Copperfield, but I think it gives us a little sense of how he was able to create character. It's Miss Moucher the Dwarf. We first meet her on page 306 here, okay? If you have a different version, this is chapter 22, some old scenes and some new people. And we first meet her because she's coming to prepare Steerforth as he goes out into the world to make sure that he is appealing. And I beg your pardon, sir, Miss Moucher is down here. Who cried Steerforth? Much astonished. Miss Moucher, sir. Why, what on earth does she do here, said Steerforth. It appears to be her native part of the country, sir. She informs me that she makes one of her professional visits here every year, sir. I met her in the street this afternoon, and she wished to know if she might have the honor of waiting on you after dinner, sir. Do you know the giantess in question, Daisy? Inquired Steerforth. I was obliged to confess, I felt ashamed, even of being at this disadvantage before Littimer, that Miss Moucher and I were wholly unacquainted. Then you shall know her, said Steerforth, for she is one of the seven wonders of the world. When Miss Moucher comes, show her in. I felt some curiosity and excitement about this lady, especially as Steerforth burst into a fit of laughing when I referred to her, and positively refused to answer any question of which I made her the subject. I remained, therefore, in a state of considerable expectation until the cloth had been removed some half an hour and we were sitting over our decanter of wine before the fire when the door opened and Littimer, with his habitual serenity, quite undisturbed, announced Miss Moucher. Now, here comes the description. Notice the bold strokes. The first thing to keep in mind, Dickens introduces a character, and even though Miss Moucher will not reappear until late in the novel, he's got to set the character in the reader's mind. It may be a year before she reappears. So he's got to make sure that during that lapse of time, if a year goes by, when she reappears at the end of the book, she will be memorable. So he is painting with broad strokes. I looked at the doorway and saw nothing. I was still looking at the doorway, thinking that Miss Moucher was a long while making her appearance, when, to my infinite astonishment, there came waddling around a sofa which stood between me and it, a pursy dwarf of about 40 or 45, with a very large head and face, a pair of roguish gray eyes, and such extremely little arms that to enable herself to lay a finger archly against her snub nose as she ogled Steerforth, she was obliged to meet the finger halfway and lay her nose against it. Her chin, which was what is called a double chin, was so fat that it entirely swallowed up the strings of her bonnet, bow and all. Throat, she had none. Waist, she had none. Legs, she had none, worth mentioning. For though she was more than full size down to where her waist would have been, if she had had any, and though she terminated, as human beings generally do, in a pair of feet, she was so short that she stood in a common-sized chair as at a table, resting a bag she carried on the seat. This lady, dressed in an offhand easy style, bringing her nose and her forefinger together with the difficulty I have described, standing with her head unnecessarily on one side and with one of her sharp eyes shut up, making an uncommonly knowing face, after ogling Steerforth for a few moments, broke into a torrent of words. "What, my flower?" she pleasantly began, shaking her large head at him. "You're there, are you? Oh, you naughty boy. Fie for shame. What do you do so far away from home? Up to mischief I'll be bound. Chatter, chatter, chatter." Unforgettable. Unforgettable. As I said, we're not going to see her again for hundreds of pages when she reappears. She'll be instantly memorable. Dickens had the knack for doing this. Where did he draw characters from? People he knew, people he'd heard about, people he encountered, or simply out of his own imagination? Actually, I've chosen Miss Moucher for a reason. There was a little dwarf woman in London at the time who apparently looked very like this. He'd heard about her. He'd not met her. But through descriptions of others, he creates this character in the book. And while he was writing Copperfield, got a letter from the original saying, "How could you be so cruel and mean-spirited? All my friends are making fun of me, saying I'm the original of Miss Moucher. I thought you were a gentleman." And Dickens was just crushed by it. So you'll notice he wrote her back and said, "Sincerest apologies. I promise you to make up to you by the time the book ends." And as here, she's sort of an unwitting accomplice of Steerforth. By the end of the book, she's courageous and instrumental in leading some of the villains to justice. And so he did indeed make it back up to her, that she becomes a heroic little dwarf. But again, part of that fairy tale world I was talking about, but quite delightful. David Copperfield, published in 1850, is what's called a Bildungsroman. It's a German word, B-I-L-D-U-N-G-S. R-O-M-A-N, Bildungsroman. And it means a novel of education, a novel of growing up. It's a standard kind of novel. We take a character at a young age and watch what the character goes through in attaining maturity. So it's that growth process. What do you learn? What happens? How do you go from being someone who is young to someone who is mature? So it falls into that category of novel writing. However, what Dickens does, quite brilliantly, is he gives us in this novel a double perspective. The novel is being written by David Copperfield later in his life. It is, if you will, a novel that's a memoir. And he calls it The Personal History of David Copperfield. Dickens' little artistic twist is that it's being written by our hero. It's a first-person novel. So he has come to a certain point in his life, and we will learn fairly early on that he is a successful writer, and he has decided to write his memoirs. So he is looking back, and we are getting a double perspective. We are getting the growth of a young person into a mature man, but we're getting it from the point of view of maturity, looking back and having the author evaluate that life as it occurs. It is done so brilliantly that we don't really notice it while it's happening, but there are little moments along the way where that double perspective shines through. And one of the themes of the book, therefore, becomes memory recollected years later. The fact that we carry experiences with us, we learn from them, but then years later as we look back on them, they are in no way the same thing to us as they were when they occurred. This tells us again something about the nature of lived life. Very often, it is regret, misunderstanding, what we would call the fall into sin. David will go through all of this. And of course, one of the principal movements of the novel is everyone around him, and the reader, as I said as well, waiting for him to wise up to the single most important fact so that he will finally fall in love with the right woman and take the proper step and marry that woman that we know he should have married long before. But he is presenting that fact to us from the moment when he's already married her. And he is documenting his own blindness. He is putting down his own inability to see properly as he is growing up. And it is the book is instructional in that way. Now here, let me give an example. This is in chapter 3, early on, page 43 in the Rotten Penguin edition. He's gone for the first time to Yarmouth, and he's met all the Peggotty family. The excitement of the ship, the overturned boat that they live in, the excitement of the seashore. He's walked along the seashore with little Emily and has formed that youthful attachment of the two innocents, if you will, in the world. Near the top of the page, she's been talking about how she wishes she could be a lady. And right from the beginning, little Emily aware that there are classes above her who live better, have more money, have more prestige, and she yearns to be part of that, will become extraordinarily destructive very soon. But she, right at the very top of the page, she was walking much too near the brink of a sort of old jetty or wooden causeway we had strolled upon, and I was afraid of her falling over. "I'm not afraid in this way," said little Emily, "but I wake when it blows and tremble to think of Uncle Dan and Ham and believe I hear him crying out for help. That's why I should like so much to be a lady. But I'm not afraid in this way, not a bit. Look here." She started from my side and ran along a jagged timber which protruded from the place we stood upon and overhung the deep water at some height without the least defense. The incident is so impressed on my remembrance that if I were a draftsman, I could draw its form here, I dare say, accurately as it was that day. And little Emily springing forward to her destruction, as it seemed to me, with a look that I have never forgotten, directed far out to sea. The very end of the next paragraph. "There has been a time since when I have wondered whether, if the life before could have been revealed to me at a glance, and so revealed as that a child could fully comprehend it, and if her preservation could have depended on a motion of my hand, I ought to have held it up to save her. There has been a time since, I do not say it lasted long, but it has been, when I have asked myself the question, would it have been better for little Emily to have had the waters close above her head that morning in my sight? And when I have answered, yes, it would have been. This may be premature. I have set it down too soon, perhaps. But let it stand." Now you're getting this ominous sense of foreshadowing, no details. But most importantly, what you're getting is that double perspective. The innocent child playing on the seashore, being a little fearful for his friend, but the older novelist who's setting down the memoirs, who now knows not just that point in time, but everything that has occurred since and what is represented by it. It's a striking moment. When you read the book, you need to keep in mind that double perspective. We're seeing basically, we're being presented two different visions, the young David and the mature David. And it happens throughout. That also explains the very first sentence in the novel. One of the great openings in English literature, unforgettable, but very curious when you look at it. David Copperfield begins his memoirs as a successful novelist saying, chapter one, I am born, whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. The first sentence already gives us the most basic theme of the novel, which is this. Given this young boy that we see born in this first chapter, and what happens to him, will he simply be a side note in his own life? That is, all the other characters may play a more important role. There may be other people in his life who are much more significant than anything he ever accomplishes or does. In a curious way, the book opens with a statement of humility. And one reason he is writing it is to find out what his own position in his own life is. I don't think this is necessarily that kind of the self alienated from the self, the one would find in modernism, the sort of thing that Walker Percy examines. I think this is rather honest self-evaluation. The moment coming in the man's life when he looks back and says, who am I? Who am I? What have I done? What has my life meant? In that sense, it is a response to that imprecation over the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, know thyself. Our author is writing the book to find out who he is. Or again, the imprecation of Socrates in the Apology, the unexamined life is not worth living. And here we have the author sitting down to examine his own life, but more importantly, what his own role in his own life is, and that is a recognition. He's not sure who he is, what his position is, and whether or not there may not be other people in his life who will be more central. It's fascinating. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born as I have been informed and believe. Please notice, he says, I don't know if I'm going to be the center of my own life. In fact, I have to take my own birth on trust. It's parenthetical, but the very next sentence is proving to us in a way what the first sentence asserted. As I have been informed and believe, on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night, it was remarked that the clock began to strike and I began to cry simultaneously. What do we have? Very clearly, time, the passing of time. This is not a birth on a sunshiny morning, okay? 12 o'clock at night, a Friday, end of the week, end of the day, the clock tolls, and of course, that sound, the clock striking, the passing of time, and I began to cry. The passing of time and sorrow. And there will be, this will be in one sense a childhood of tears. It's underlined by the fact that it's true of all of us, that first slap to make us take the first breath, but nevertheless, what we do first, Shakespeare and King Lear, when we are born, we wail and cry that we are come onto this great stage of fools. Okay? We begin our lives with weeping. Now, let me continue. I'm going through the opening page closely because, again, a great writer is going to lay out what we need to know. So in order to get the themes of the novel, we have to look here. In consideration of the day and hour of my birth, it was declared by the nurse and by some sage women in the neighborhood who had taken a lively interest in me several months before there was any possibility of our becoming personally acquainted. Dickens is wondering. He's a comic writer. This is delightful stuff. Again, it's very difficult for young people to see the jokes. There's so many words there. First, that I was destined to be unlucky in life, and secondly, that I was privileged to see ghosts and spirits. Both these gifts, inevitably attaching, as they believed, to all unlucky infants of either gender born towards the small hours of a Friday night. Emphasized again, unlucky, sorrow, bad luck. The two things things that will follow him. One, he would be unlucky in life. It's connected with the crying. And number two, that he would be privileged to see ghosts and spirits. It doesn't happen in this book, okay? Dickens was aware of it. He'd already used it. He'd already written about 7 years before A Christmas Carol, the vision of those ghosts, the ghost of Marley coming to Scrooge. But he doesn't use it here. But he introduces the idea here for an important reason. If we're talking about ghosts and spirits, let me go back to Christmas Carol. Do you remember the wonderful scene? It's the wonderful scene where Scrooge comes home on that Christmas Eve and then hears the chains rattling and coming up the stairs, and he's frightened, and suddenly the door of his room flies open. There's Marley's ghost. And Scrooge addresses the ghost and says, You look like Jacob Marley. Are you really there, Jacob? Or are you just an undigested bit of beef? It's a wonderful line, okay? are you a real ghost there, or did I eat too much at dinner? Well, it's a comic line, but it goes to the core of ghosts and spirits. That is discernment. Discernment. Being able to judge properly whether that ghost is a real ghost. Whether what you see before you is there or not. And a fundamental theme of this novel is going to be discernment. Looking at souls and not figuring out if they're ghosts or not, but rather for David, trying to get the measure of all these human beings that he's going to encounter. And as we go through the novel, and I'll point out examples of it, we have crucial moments in the book when David has to decide with whom to stand, on whom to depend. He is in one way making his way in the world, and he is choosing his friends and his protectors. I'll just give two quick examples. He is sent to Mr. Creakle's school. I'll talk about that at length a little later. But he instantly chooses Steerforth as his friend. This is going to define every single thing that happens in the novel. It is a matter of discernment. Who is this young man? What's the attachment to him? And what does it say about the friends we make in our youth? And how do we determine who should be a friend? Who do we commit to? Who we spend time with? Whose values become our values? I'll expand on that later. It's a decision. David makes the wrong decision. It is bad discernment. He chooses the wrong friend. Fortunately, again, this is a Dickens novel. Who's huddling in the background? And we'll look at him shortly too, as a poor little pathetic soul called Tommy Traddles, who's just drawing skeletons on his chalkboard one after another. Traddles is going to become the true friend, but it's going to take a long while before that becomes clear. Secondly, the moment when the little child is in near despair. He can no longer stand his life. He can no longer stand the Murdstones working in the blacking factory. It's Creakle's school. It is a vision of horror. And he decides he will run away to Aunt Betsy Trotwood's. It is a moment of discernment. All he knows of the woman is that when he was born, she smacked the doctor with her bonnet. Well, look at the scene. It's wonderful. And left the house angry. But he takes a chance somehow from what his mother has said and his own intuitions that if he's going to run anywhere, he must run there. It is a proper discernment. He chooses well. He ends up not only being sheltered, but being cared for and has a protector for life. So that, that I was privileged to see ghosts and spirits. No. But it is the question of discernment raised right in that second paragraph in the novel. And it's an incredibly important question, not just for the young, but for everybody. Who are the friends you make? Who are the people you spend time with? And how do you judge those around you and know they won't turn on you, they won't betray you, that you have made a wise choice? I need say nothing here on the first head, okay? That is that he was unlucky. Because nothing can show better than my history whether that prediction was verified or falsified by the result. On the second branch of the question, I will only remark that unless I ran through that part of my inheritance while I was still a baby, I have not come into it yet. But I do not at all complain of having been kept out of this property, and if anybody else should be present in the present enjoyment of it, he is heartily welcome to keep it. Well, it's a little joke, but of course we're going to find out, no, David has learned discernment. By the end of the novel, he does learn discernment, but not in that way, not in ghosts and spirits. Notice what comes next. I was born with a caul, C-A-U-L, which was advertised for sale in the newspapers at the low price of 15 guineas. A caul is a membrane that some children are born in. They come out of the womb wrapped in this membrane. It was considered at the time to be a thing of great good luck, and would, if you owned a caul, you never had to worry about drowning at sea. Where the superstition comes from, no one knows. Please notice how this continues. Whether seagoing people were short of money about that time, or were short of faith and preferred cork jackets, I don't know. They got themselves real life preservers. They didn't need a lucky object at home. Please notice what we've got here in the first page of the novel. Drowning. Drowning at sea. It will be the climax of the entire novel. We are going to have two characters who drown at sea in the climactic scene that comes at the end of the novel, and he's already preparing for it in the fourth paragraph. It's comic here, it's lighthearted, but throughout this novel, drowning is of enormous importance. We'll see another example of it in just a few minutes. Why is drowning so important? Well, because the sea becomes two different things in this novel. The sea becomes the image of the mysteries of life that we can't know. When David begins to perceive that life is a mystery, and when he is forced to break for the first time out of his content little world of Peggotty, his mother, the house, the little yard, that perfect little world, self-contained, where he can be happy. That world is shattered with the coming of Mr. Murdstone. And at that moment, when Mr. Murdstone is arriving, David is taken to the sea. And the sea is vast, huge, and mysterious as life itself. And we have little Emily yearning for the sea. David aware of the possibilities of the sea, overcoming one. At that moment, when he first arrives at the Peggottys, and they begin talking about various folks in the family, and he raises names. Just read this very quickly. Why is he called Ham? Why, his father gave it to him, said Mr. Peggotty. I thought you were his father. My brother Joe was his father, said Mr. Peggotty. Dead, Mr. Peggotty, I hinted. Drowned, said Mr. Peggotty. Okay? Little Emily, she is your daughter, isn't she, Mr. Peggotty? No, sir, my brother-in-law Tom was her father. I couldn't help it. Dead, Mr. Peggotty, I hinted, after another respectful silence. Drowned, said Mr. Peggotty. I felt the difficulty of resuming the subject, but had not got to the bottom of it yet. Please notice, it is that vision of the immensity of the unknown. The sea is the unknown. Just as life is unknown to the child, sort of standing on the brink of it, ready to head into it. The sea is threatening. The sea is destructive. And what is it about drowning that is a particularly frightening death is that the personality is overwhelmed. If you will, the person meets the water and the water wins. The terrible vision of someone who is drowned, and often you can't even find the body. It's out there in the water somewhere. You don't know how to locate it. And then if, sometime later, the body should wash up on shore, the body is unrecognizable because the water has completely transformed it. The water has so suffused the body that one can no longer even identify it. There is, notice again, in that fear of drowning and the notion of drowning, something similar to the first sentence, will I be the hero of my own life? Or am I just going to be swamped by experiences and other people and end up being nobody? Will I drown in my own life? Will I ever have identity? What does identity mean? And at this moment, it's a little joke he's talking about in the call, born in the call, which saves one from drowning. But drowning will be a major theme, a major idea, and the climax of the book. And the climax of the book. Whether seagoing people were short of money about that time or were short of faith and preferred cork jackets, I don't know. All I know is that there was but one solitary bidding, and that was from an attorney connected with the bill-broking business who offered £2 in cash and the balance in sherry, but declined to be guaranteed from drowning on any higher bargain. Consequently, the advertisement was withdrawn at a dead loss, for as to sherry, my poor dear mother's own sherry was in the market then, and 10 years afterwards, the call was put up in a raffle down in our part of the country to 50 members at half a crown a head, the winner to spend 5 shillings. I was present myself, and I remember to have felt quite uncomfortable and confused at a part of myself being disposed of in that way. Notice what happened. This, again, is going to happen throughout his childhood. He's quite literally going to be bargained off for money. Mr. Murdstone's going to make him go and work to get money off this kid in the blacking factory so that the child at a young age will be useful, put to work. And we get already the little hint of that coming, that one can literally lose parts of oneself to merchandising. Victorian London, a world of money, a world of money, where they'll even sell off parts of you. The call here, a little joke, but Mr. Murdstone will sell off David's innocence in order to make a little cash off him. The call was won, I recollect, by an old lady with a handbasket, who very reluctantly produced from it the stipulated 5 shillings, all in halfpence and tuppence halfpenny short, and as it took an immense time and a great waste of arithmetic to endeavor without any effect to prove to her. It is a fact, which will be long remembered as remarkable down there, that she was never drowned, but died triumphantly in bed at 92. I have understood that it was, to the last, her proudest boast that she had never been on the water in her life, except upon a bridge, and that over her tea, to which she was extremely partial, she did at last expressed her indignation at the impiety of mariners and others who had the presumption to go meandering about the world. It was in vain to represent to her that some conveniences, tea perhaps included, resulted from this objectionable practice. She always returned with greater emphasis and with an instinctive knowledge of the strength of her objection, "Let us have no meandering. Not to meander myself at present, I will go back to my birth." But notice, we have the two impulses, the two life impulses. You're born, you stay where you are. Don't be uppity, don't go wandering around the world. You've been given your little square of it, be content in it, settle in there, get to know it well. Let us have no meandering. And young David, who of course is going to spend a lifetime meandering, The alternate choice, going out into that unknown world, moving through it, not aware of what he's going to encounter out there, and having, if you will, to construct a life. The question being, what kind of life is then constructed? He chooses the latter course. He chooses the latter course. Or we might say it's forced upon him. It's forced upon him. just quickly. What does that opening page of the introduction tell us? One, the question of good and bad luck in life. We're back to the question of fortune. Back to the question of fortune. I would say it goes all the way back to the Knight's Tale. What will be sent you? Are you going to have good fortune or bad fortune? Two, sorrow in the world. The clear sense at the beginning of the book is that this young man is going to meet with misfortune, it's going to be a life of sorrow and sadness. Three, discernment. What does it mean to go out into the world and be able to tell the true from the false? Who's your friend? Who's your enemy? Who will protect you? Who will be a danger to you? Four, the whole idea of drowning. I would put it this way, the loss of identity. Being swamped by events, being swamped by the world, never finding out who you are and simply being washed away in a flood of events and becoming part of that vast sea of life, no definition, no understanding, which therefore can lead one to say, I want a quiet life. I just want to sit quietly at home. Let us have no meandering. And events of life forcing David out into the world, so he has to begin living. Now, all that set up, and then we begin the story proper. With David's mother pregnant and his father dead. The first references that we get: my father's eyes closed upon the light of the world 6 months when my opened on it. His father's been dead for 6 months. He is born into the world and has no father. Okay? The first two figures we meet, his mother and Betsy Trotwood, the aunt. Very different female figures. His mother, very soft, very demure, rather willful in her quiet way, and very loving. And Aunt Betsy Trotwood, aggressive, assertive, willful, strong-minded, opinionated, tough old broad, if you will, okay? Very different kinds of women. They both, however, have raised about them the question of the marriage they have made as soon as we learn about them. Bottom of page 12, I'm in the first chapter, right at the beginning. The first thing we learn about Miss Trotwood, or Miss Betsy, as my poor mother always called her, when she sufficiently overcame her dread of this formidable personage to mention her at all, which was seldom, had been married to a husband younger than herself, who was very handsome, except in the sense of the homely adage, handsome is that handsome does. He looked great. He was a rat. For he was strongly suspected of having beaten Miss Betsy, and even of having once, on a disputed question of supplies, made some hasty but determined arrangements to throw her out of a two pair of stairs window. Okay? A miserable marriage. What we learn is he vanished. News came years later of his death. Two, next paragraph, okay? My father had once been a favorite of hers, I believe, but she was mortally affronted by his marriage on the ground that my mother was a wax doll. She had never seen my mother, but she knew her to be not yet 20. My father and Miss Betsy never met again. Betsy Trotwood makes a bad marriage. Out of it, she learns the importance of making a good marriage. Her favorite nephew, okay, marries a pretty young thing. Betsy assumes she's a wax doll. He's married for looks. And they never meet again. What do we have here? We've got the question of the bad marriage. The question of the bad marriage. Marriage rises up again. There's a theme here you may notice in many of these works. They haven't been chosen accidentally. It's a major theme in the Canterbury Tales. It's a major theme in Midsummer Night's Dream. It shows up again in David Copperfield. Discernment in making a good marriage. But there's something else that needs to be said, and that's very important here. The first human beings we learn about in this novel are all those neighbor women who are so concerned about the widow Copperfield's forthcoming baby. Then we learn about Aunt Betsy. We learn about the woman who buys the call. Then we learn about Aunt Betsy Trotwood. Then we learn more about David's mother. Then we're going to meet Peggotty. This is a world of women. This is a world entirely populated by women. The father is either dead, David's father dead, or the other vision is of Betsy Trotwood's husband, who was handsome but corrupt, beat her, and vanished, ran off and left her. Into this world, young David is born, and notice that the little joke at the beginning of Betsy Trotwood, assuming that it's going to be a girl, proclaiming it's got to be a girl, proclaiming that the baby will be named Betsy Trotwood Copperfield, and when the baby turns out to be a boy, taking it out on Dr. Chillip by pounding him with her bonnet and storming out, is that we are dealing with a world in which boys and men are unacceptable because they are lacking any sort of life or moral authority. And this is the world that David is born into. It is a very comfortable world and a rather pleasant world, but he is aware from the beginning that somehow there seems to be something wrong with him because he's not Betsy Trotwood Copperfield. I'm at the very end of chapter 1. The baby, said my aunt, how is she? Ma'am, returned Mr. Chillip, I apprehended you had known. It's a boy. My aunt said never a word, but took her bonnet by the strings in the manner of a sling, aimed a blow at Mr. Chillip's head with it, put it on bent, walked out, and never came back. She vanished like a discontented fairy, or like one of those supernatural beings whom it was properly supposed I was entitled to see and never came back anymore. Notice two things happening there. Dickens using fairy tale language. She vanished like a discontented fairy. He does this through all the novels. The fairy tale references are buried there. And she was like one of those spirits he was supposed to see. Well, when the moment comes and he doesn't know where to go and decides to run to her, he is making a discernment of spirits, but human spirits. This does not bode well. For the little boy, he's got to be pretty desperate if he's going to this woman who's done this when he is born. No, I lay in my basket and my mother lay in her bed, but Betsy Trotwood Copperfield was forever in the land of dreams and shadows, the tremendous region whence I had so lately traveled. And the light upon the window of our room shone out upon the earthly bourne of all such travelers, and the mound above the ashes, and the dust that once was he, without whom I had never been. The father is ashes. He feels he should have been a little girl. He should have been born a little girl. Please notice when. And there, the ghastly introduction takes it to a sick place. But there is the fact, when he meets Steerforth, notice the nickname that Steerforth gives him, Daisy. When he meets Dora, her nickname for him is Dodie. When he finally does meet Aunt Betsy, he becomes Trotwood Copperfield. At least, it's male, it's not Betsy Trotwood Copperfield, but an echo of that girl she hoped would be born. One of the themes of the novel is how do you come to manhood? This is the dawn of modernity here, and Dickens seems to be aware in this novel, something's happened. Where are the men? Where are the men who are going to raise this boy? And what we get, I'll get into this later, but please notice, the two surrogate fathers are Mr. Murdstone and Mr. Micawber. Very different, but those are the two who they're the two male figures there to raise the boy. To raise the boy, okay? Now, boy. I will. I'm nearing the end of the two hours of lecturing this morning. I'm approaching chapter 2. These things happen. In any case, I'm setting up the terms by which the novel can be read and should be read. I'll do this. Let me just say this quickly. Chapter 2, the dawning of the child's observations, the world around him. It's absolutely stunning. Just the first paragraph. Just the first paragraph. It's classic. The first objects that assume a distinct presence before me as I look far back into the blank of my infancy are my mother with her pretty hair and youthful shape, and Peggotty with no shape at all, and eyes so dark that they seem to darken their whole neighborhood in her face, and cheeks and arms so hard and red that I wondered the birds didn't peck her in preference to apples. Oh, the joy of creation in these sentences. The imagination in Dickens is wonderful. And then the whole world around him begins to come into clarity. And he talks about never quite losing that sense, okay? Being able to think far back in time being an important part of your later life. This may be fancy. This is the third paragraph of chapter 2. This may be fancy, though I think the memory of most of us can go farther back into such times than many of us suppose. Just as I believe the power of observation in numbers of very young children to be quite wonderful for its closeness and accuracy. Indeed, I think that most grown men who are remarkable in this respect may with greater propriety be said not to have lost the faculty than to have acquired it. The rather, as I generally observe, such men to retain a certain freshness and gentleness and capacity of being pleased, which are also an inheritance they have preserved from their childhood. Those powers of observation in the child coming to consciousness need to be preserved. And in those who have powers of observation later, there must be something of the freshness of a child's first discovery. It's a wonderful idea. I had a moment this weekend sitting talking with some folks about first memories of childhood. Play the game. Go back. Try to remember what is the first thing that comes into focus in your world. Why is it that? What was connected with it? How intensely can you remember it and describe it? There is a reason. There is that moment when we come to consciousness and become aware of there's me. And then there's something out there. And that awareness, that coming to consciousness, is the dawning of an awareness of an individual life lived in the world. That kind of uniqueness. One might even say that consciousness that is necessarily combined with language has something to do with the growth of the soul itself. Walker Percy, writing about Helen Keller, living deaf, dumb, and blind, not knowing language, having no consciousness of herself, living like an animal. In order to begin to be civilized, to live a life, to know that there is a self, we need consciousness, we need language. God put those things there for a reason, so that the moment when we first become conscious is a crucial moment. And what we retain of it and how well we retain that consciousness will define us for the rest of our lives, Dickens says. I think there's something very, very accurate, there. There is also that sense, he will speak of it, the purity, the simplicity, the happiness of childhood. It doesn't last long for David, but it is there. I'm on page 24. Again, it's in sort of the middle of chapter 2. He remembers going outside the house. First his mother and Peggotty. We remember people first. Then the house. Then he makes a little trip outside. There's a wonderful moment where he goes out and he's terrified. There's a rooster out there. There is one cock who gets upon a post to crow and seems to take particular notice of me as I look at him through the kitchen window. It makes me shiver. He is so fierce. That outside world's threatening. Better to stay inside. But notice as well, it's a rooster. It's manhood again. It's that image of manliness. He wants to stay inside with the ladies, with his mother and Peggotty, who will protect him. He finally does go outside, and now I see the outside of our house with the latticed bedroom windows standing open to let in the sweet-smelling air, and the ragged old rook's nest still dangling in the elm trees at the bottom of the front garden. Now I am in the garden at the back. He first goes outside, and what does he enter? The garden, okay? It's beautiful. It's innocence. And childhood has that moment of innocence for a precious, precious few years. Children can partake of that innocence. Now I am in the garden at the back, beyond the yard, where the empty pigeon house and dog kennel are, a very preserve of butterflies, as I remember it, with a high fence and a gate and a padlock, where the fruit clusters on the trees, riper and richer than fruit has ever been since in any other garden, and where my mother gathers some in a basket while I stand by bolting furtive gooseberries and trying to look unmoved. She's gathering fruit, putting it in the basket, and he's stealing gooseberries, trying not to get caught. A great wind rises, and the summer is gone in a moment. Whew, it's beautiful writing. And that innocence, quite literally, the winter wind comes and just blows it away. But still, he remembers, indoor, it's preserved for, we are playing in the winter twilight, dancing about the parlor. When my mother is out of breath and rests herself in an elbow chair, I watch her winding her bright curls round her fingers and straightening her waist, and nobody knows better than I do that she likes to look so well and is proud of being so pretty. Beautiful memories of his mother. Then, notice the transition into the outside world intruding, coming in. He's sitting with Peggotty. They've been reading, and suddenly asks her, "Peggotty," says I suddenly, "were you ever married?" "Lord, Master Davy," replied Peggotty, "what puts marriage in your head?" She answered with such a start that it quite awoke me. And then she stopped in her work and looked at me with her needle drawn out to its thread's length. "But were you ever married, Peggotty?" says I. "You are a very handsome woman, aren't you?" I thought her in a different style from my mother, certainly, but of another school of beauty. I considered her a perfect example. It's the wonderful, again, not just the innocence of the child, but the non-judgmental nature of the child. His mother's very beautiful. Peggotty's very beautiful. But he knows it's a different kind of beauty. I just love it. "Me handsome, Davy," said Peggotty. "Look, no, my dear, but what put marriage in your head?" And then the conversation goes, "But if you marry a person and the person dies, why, then you may marry another person, mayn't you, Peggotty?" "You may," says Peggotty, "if you choose, my dear. That's a matter of opinion." "My opinion," said Peggotty, taking her eyes from me after a little indecision going on with her work, "that I never was married myself, Master Davy, and that I don't expect to be. That's all I know about the subject." "You ain't cross, I suppose, Peggotty, are you?" said I, after sitting quiet for a moment. I really thought she was. She had been so short with me, but I was mistaken. She hugs him and then says, "Now let us hear some more about the Crokindills," said Peggotty, who is not quite right in the name yet, for I ain't heard half enough. It's the crocodile book they're reading. He begins reading to her about the crocodiles again, and in comes Murdstone. comes the discussion of, can someone who's been married be married again? We go back to the crocodile book. That vicious, fierce, devouring creature in nature. That threatening creature. We had exhausted the crocodiles and begun with the alligators when the garden bell rang. The crocodile is in the garden. Okay. We went out to the door, and there was my mother looking unusually pretty, I thought, and with her a gentleman with beautiful black hair and whiskers who had walked home with us from church last Sunday. Notice the connections. Crocodile through the garden, handsome black hair and whiskers, and the church connection. Okay? The Murdstones are going to embody a religious vision. And therefore, the first association who had walked home with us from church last Sunday. That's page 26, page 27, middle of the page. They shake hands. He gives them why, that's the wrong hand, Davy, laughed the gentleman. My mother drew my right hand forward, but I was resolved for my former reason not to give it to him, and I did not. The instinct of the child does not want to shake hands with this man. I gave him the other and shook it heartily and said I was a brave fellow and went away. He shook it heartily and said I was a brave fellow and went away. At this minute, I see him turn round in the garden and give us a last look with his ill-omened black eyes before the door was shut. It's over. The innocence is over. The serpent has entered the garden. The serpent has entered the garden. The next thing that happens, how do we know it? Peggotty and his mother have a fight. He hears them arguing. And they're fighting about remarriage. And who she may remarry. And then they collapse in each other's arms in tears. But trouble has entered the house. Trouble has come into the house. And then Murdstone is there all the time. He takes David out on an outing where they're all his friends, just snotty and condescending, the little boy, have a conversation about him in his presence and call him Brooks of Sheffield. Again, denying his identity, okay? The hint of the water imagery again. And then, confusion to Brooks of Sheffield, they drink, making a toast. And Mr. Murdstone has him walk along a cliff. We walked about on a cliff after that. Again, the sense. Just as little Emily will run along the parapet, okay, so Murdstone and David walk along the cliff. We have the sense of there is a dangerous world out there. There is a dangerous world out there. He goes off to Yarmouth, which becomes it cannot be the garden. It cannot be the garden. Yarmouth is a pleasant place, an idyllic place within the world, but it's a place, what do we find out? It's a place of death. It's a place where fathers die. Where's Ham's father? Drowned. Where's little Emily's father? Drowned. And again, the fathers are gone. You have the uncle, Daniel Peggotty, a good man who's raising the children. Raising his brother's children. Who will be a father figure again. Who will be a father figure. But all the fathers in the book are gone. They're all gone. He's there. He has a good time. And then returns home. I've got to run through. I'll look very quickly at the very end of chapter 3. They get back. He knows something is wrong by Peggotty's behavior. He can tell something is wrong. He thinks his mother has died too. No, it's not that. And bottom of 48, Master Davy, said Peggotty, untying her bonnet with a shaking hand and speaking in a breathless sort of way. What do you think? You have got a pa. I trembled and turned white. Something, I don't know what or how, connected with the grave in the church and the raising of the dead, seemed to strike me like an unwholesome wind. In a way, I guess you could say that Murdstone is connected with a ghost or a spirit or an evil genius. A new one, said Peggotty. A new one, I repeated. Peggotty gave a gasp as if she were swallowing something that was very hard and putting out her hand said, come and see him. I don't want to see him. And your mama, said Peggotty. So he goes in, his mother on one side of the fire, Murdstone on the other. My mother dropped her work and rose hurriedly but timidly, I thought. Now, Clara, my dear, said Mr. Murdstone, recollect, control yourself, always control yourself. Davy boy, how do you do? I gave him my hand. After a moment of suspense, I went and kissed my mother. She kissed me, patted me gently on the shoulder, and sat down again to her work. I could not look at her. I could not look at him. I knew quite well that he was looking at both of us. And I turned to the window and looked out there at some shrubs that were drooping their heads in the cold. As soon as I could creep away, I crept upstairs. My old dear bedroom was changed, and I was to lie a long way off. I rambled downstairs to find anything that was like itself. So altered it all seemed, and roamed into the yard. I very soon started back from there, for the empty dog kennel was filled up with a great dog, deep-mouthed and black-haired like him, and he was very angry at the sight of me and sprung out to get at me. The doghouse that had been the haunt of butterflies is now filled with a black dog that comes out after the little boy. And we've gone from that innocent world, that perfect world, that garden-like world, where not only has there been a fall, but there are now monsters there waiting to destroy the child.